Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Red, White, and Rude, where culture, pop culture, and politics collide. As I believe politics is downstream of culture, today we'll discuss journalism, but not political journalism, but gaming journalism. Why? Easy. They're literally mirrors of one another, political and gaming. You know what? So is literally every industry in America today. That includes my original career, fantasy sports, where I had over 200 NFL beat reporters working for me. They're all the same. And from there, we'll cover Captain America, A Brave New World. And how did it do its opening weekend? And then we'll finalize it with the Rude Rundown, where I tackle stories from around the country and around the world in a not-so-rapid fire, but a quick synopsis and analysis. So stay tuned, my friends. Once again, hello, everybody. This is William Del Pilar. And this is Red, White, and Rude. And before we go on, do not forget you can find this podcast as well as our other podcasts on politics and sports at grumblingsmedia.com as well as Rumble, YouTube, Apple, Spotify, y Pandora under the handle Grumblings Media. So let's talk about some gaming journalism. First up, game reviewers will dock you points on your game for putting the Gulf of America on it. And let me show you exactly who I am talking about. First of all, you heard that right. Can you actually believe someone's actually docking points off video game reviews on how they label a map? Let me repeat. Game reviewers will dock you points on your game for putting the Gulf of America in it. So there's this reviewer you're looking at, Liana Hafer, formerly known as TJ Hafer, formerly known as Len Hafer. I assume Len is probably correct since he went to Liana. And Hafer works for IGN and PC Gamer. I would assume Hafer's a freelancer of sorts. Well, anyway, Hafer's out there saying he'll knock points off games if they call the Gulf of America the Gulf. I'm sorry, I keep saying the Gulf of America. If they call the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. Talk about your politics at work here, you know. Again, Liana Hafer, a.k.a. Len Hafer, is also transgender, as you can see by that image there. And that explains Hafer's hatred of Trump. Hey, I get it. Transgender community is not with Trump. I get it. But it's Hafer's job not to push Hafer's hate onto other, as Hafer is doing here. Now, this whole renaming thing, it came from an executive order by President Trump calling the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. And that has obviously stirred up quite a bit of debate, you know? This is gaming reviews turned into political activism. You know, instead of focusing on whether a game is any good, in the various categories it should be judged on, we're now looking at how politically correct the map is. You know, this isn't new, though. They've been political with reviews for, I don't know, 20, 30 years now. And it's one reason we no longer trust them and why our trust left gaming journalism quickly. Social media has had a field day with this. Some are laughing, some are pissed, but some like me, we look at it and I go, that's validation. It's validation from what I've been saying. Gaming journalism is corrupt, woke, and filled with DEI hires. So what does this mean for the gaming journalism industry? Well, there's a reality that reviews are unfair and filled with political statements and activism. We've always known that. To see somebody admit it, I dare you. I dare you to put Gulf of America in your game. I'll dock you 1 point. Truth is, we gamers no longer care what these reviewers have to say. I mean, they lost our trust long ago, and life is about trust, isn't it? What it should do is make you think how much influence media has on our culture. Are we getting objective reviews, or are we just seeing someone's political agenda? It's a big conversation about where we are heading or have arrived with media and journalism. So let's do a little bit of a deeper dive into this. Let's go into something that is infamous in the gaming world. let's see where I'm at. Oh, before we do that, I have to talk about Liana Hafer once more. Obviously, she's a transgender, a contributor to IGN and PC Gamer. And as I've said, she's publicly stated that video games employing the term Gulf of America would result in a lower review score. The reason I haven't let her go yet is, think about it, it's a bit ironic. Because what she's doing is dead naming. And that is taboo in the transgender community. Dead naming is the act of using a transgender person's birth name versus their chosen name. Notice I haven't called him. It's Leon. He's going by now, but Leon or TJ was the name previously. They consider it discriminatory, rude, everything negative. If I called him Leon or TJ and not Leona or what is it? Liana. Yeah, if I don't call her Liana. It's criticized for being insensitive, and it's a disregard for somebody's gender identity, how they identify. Yet here's Hafer essentially advocating a practice akin to dead naming by threatening gaming companies that they will be penalized for using Gulf of America. Well, I got news for you, Hafer. Leo, I am offended by the fact that you are triggering me because you have dead named the Gulf of America. It's not the Gulf of Mexico anymore. It's Gulf of America. And that name has been respected. Google and Apple and others have respected my feelings about calling it the Gulf of America. So specifically President Trump's feelings. So this should raise questions about conspiracy and advocacy for respect towards names and identities. Of course, I'm being sarcastic, but that's technically I am correct in what Hafer has done. Is it just the transgender community that decides right and wrong here? It would appear so. Why advocate against dead naming, but then support what might be considered a form of geopolitical dead naming? And to show you how woke, how bigoted Hafer is, she gave Dragon Age The Veilguard a 9 out of 10. Did the transgender quest have anything to do with that rating? Did she bump it up a point? I say that because across the board from non-gaming journalism, Dragon Age The Veilguard was mediocre at best. Terrible by most. Anyway, you know, doing this research for this took me down the rabbit hole. So we're going to go back to Gamergate. And the reason I want to bring Gamergate up is, one, it's very infamous in the history of gaming. And two, it does relate to this. So I did get some of this information from somebody called Katawashunen on Reddit. And he posted a thread that was very informative, and it aligned with what I had done with my research. What he did is he obviously consolidated all of Gamergate. And Gamergate was about corruption in gaming journalism and competitions. There was, at the time, a demand for disclosure and an ethics reform. Why? Well, gaming journalism has been supported for decades by advertising from game producers, not subscriptions. They would give the subscriptions away at GameStop, for example, one of the magazines, because they wanted the sheer numbers so they could go to advertisers and jack those prices up. This, however, created a dependency on advertising coming from the companies that actually made a game who are trying to advertise your game. It was an ugly symbiotic relationship, and they were compromised. This environment fostered a culture where negative reviews were risky. It potentially led to loss of access to review copies or advertising revenue. I have known about this for well over 30 years, so at least a generation, because of my industry, the fantasy sports industry, where you couldn't really give a bad review to a fantasy software company. That's where the battle was in. They were trying to gain dominance in who used their software to play fantasy sports, in essence, house their leagues. So I saw this in that avenue. I also saw it in the gambling avenue early on. It was monster money, but you couldn't really knock their gambling company. Our company did not do gambling company reviews, so we weren't affected by that. So this rift between gamers and journalists has been simmering for years. So the Gamergate situation actually turned into a battleground for gender politics rather than focusing on what it was originally created for, and that was concerns about the ethics of game journalism. And the shift obviously sidelined any potential or meaningful dialogue about journalism's role and responsibilities. The gamers are the last ones to understand the realities of the world. This had been going on in the political world for generations. The controversy began with personal drama. There was an individual named Zoe Quinn who was involved in Gamergate, and her boyfriend or ex-boyfriend at the point released a blog, and it escalated into a broader critique of gaming journalism's ethics. Zoe Quinn was a gaming developer. Now, I'm not saying this is 100% true. This is my research. I don't know any of these individuals, but I have been a gamer since the 70s, believe it or not. But anyway, so this individual slept with journalists who then gave her game very favorable reviews when the gaming community thought the game was not very good. She also got a gaming fundraiser shut down just before starting her own gaming fundraiser. A PR agent also slept with the head judge of a game festival, and her client's games won. So in that sense, this is like the casting couch done in reverse. Well, actually, no, it's a casting couch. But they're willing to sleep for the good reviews, you know? Now, this spread feminist outrage on social media. The two women above, as well as others related to the industry, jumped into a heated discussion to defend women and deny all of this. Some of them received death threats. All sides condemned the harassments and threats. Let me talk to you about death threats. They're common. I'm not trying to say that they diminish them. Literally every industry, you get death threats. We were always threatened to be taken to the attorney generals. Man, that guy didn't score the 4 touchdowns that you said he did, or he would, you know. I mean, every industry has death threats, especially when big money's involved or career situations like this. And most of them can be blown off. It's funny because Democrats always talk about death threats. But then they never talk not one time when, say, for example, the conservative SCOTUSes were not given Secret Service protection and death threats were thrown at them, and Justice Kavanaugh had to face off against somebody. They never talk about those. It's always the left who talk about the dire need and how bad it is. When it's the conservatives or anybody else, no big deal. It's in between. So, in essence, this became to feminists coming out to defend him, and they did what I call an Alinsky tactic. What they did was they did not attack the message and what it was all about. They attacked the messenger. The allegations of corruption were not addressed. The allegations of corruption and conflicts of interest in game journalism were ignored and dismissed. Media outlets chose not to address or acknowledge the issue, instead choosing silence or deflection. Some media outlets try to suppress information or discussions, which is a given. They're going to protect themselves. And that only amplified the backlash due to the Streisand effect. Now, here's what's interesting about the Streisand effect. The Streisand effect occurs when an attempt to hide or censor information inadvertently leads to greater publicity and awareness of that information. Barbara Streisand sued a photographer who was taking overhead pictures for the Coastal Commission, and her home on the beach was caught in the pictures. So she sued. Only six people had seen that, had downloaded that. When she, after the she sued, it became public, thousands saw it, and she lost her lawsuit. But regardless, them not acknowledging it, them ignoring it, dismissing it, or just plain silent, you know, that led to further distrust from gamers towards game journalism. This distrust had already happened in politics, for example. Gamers were outraged at the anti-gamer sites who ran the article stereotyping and shaming their own fan base. So what happened here is these gaming magazines, these pro-gaming magazine allies, they started blaming the fan base. Gamers noted that 10 plus sites all ran similar talking points on the same day, and that was an industry-wide issue. And that happens. We're just discovering now with the USAID debacle how there are so many layers, and Democrats work in conjunction. And I suspect a lot of that working in conjunction came out from NGOs that were being funded by USAID. But it can be done in any form. There's one central point, and it sends out, here's your talking points. And they noticed 10 plus sites all ran similar talking points. So they dug deeper into this web of industry, the relationships, and they did uncover conflicts of interest. And when it went south was when they started to realize that radical anti-male feminists, we refer to them as social justice warriors, were driving this narrative in the press. They were deflecting. This is the Alinsky tactic, a well-known tactic. You don't attack the message, you attack the messenger, meaning you don't debate the issue, you just attack those talking about the issue. Articles emerged in the BBC and the Guardian in defending the social justice warriors. But they don't mention the original issue of corruption in terms of what this whole debacle was about. But they focus on issues to make them the victim. The female author of The Guardian, this is what's killer. She was financially supportive of the women she defended her articles. They called her out publicly, as they should have, showing this is a hypocrisy in ethical standards. Gamers did not feel betrayed. Gamers were just validating what they were starting to believe and see in terms of the hypocrisy in gaming journalism. Gaming journalists who would normally, like any other industry, chase a story in the gaming world, suddenly became silent or defensive when their practices came under scrutiny. Gamers are convinced that they had the proof of corruption. Social justice warriors were convinced they had the proof of misogyny. I saw the proof in the corruption. I had never saw the proof of the misogyny, but it's there. Whether you're Black, Latino, white, Asian, or whatnot, you have your nut jobs. So to fight back, gamers use this Not Your Shield hashtag. Why? As they always do, they were saying the gaming community is made up of white cis males. So minority gamers came out with the movement Not Your Shield, meaning don't hide behind us. They tell such as social justice warriors they don't need anyone speaking for them. I've run into this problem with this white suburban woman. I saw it literally every single day growing up and how they treated my mother with her broken English, looking like a Chinese woman from a deep Manchurian agent. Yeah. And I saw it every day, and I've never forgotten that. So when I saw this resurface after the turn of the century, after Obama took power, I'm like, I see it for what it is. It's what you call white or Anglo superiority. They think because they're educated, because they can speak in English, because they have their suburban life, they need to help us po-Latinos and po-Blacks. You know? And that's what we were seeing here. Then you have your third-party trolls. They just fan the flames for everything. Yeah. So this went on for a while, eventually died down. Then is when that boyfriend came out with the indie game. The ex-boyfriend of Zoe Quinn came out. Zoe Quinn is known for the indie game Depression Quest. She's one who's been accused of unethical behavior, allegedly cheated with 5 men in the indie game and journalism scene during her relationship with the boyfriend who threw her under the bus and came out with this information. She reportedly expressed some type of frustration towards an organizer of something called Game Jam after it failed. She wanted their head on a stick. She just showed her viciousness. She showed she was really a mean girl. You know, all this is allegedly. The event was criticized for its heavy-handed corporate influence, poor organization, and attempts to create drama rather than focusing on game development. This is Game Jam. And it failed. I think, it failed after like less than, it was supposed to be 4 days. After a day, it kind of fell apart. So she organized Rebel Jam. The problem here was direct donation links to her PayPal. There weren't any details on event timing and content, and the event actually did not take place as planned. It was being put on by some group called the Fine Young Capitalists. Man, this is just a mess. It's just a nightmare. The event faced criticism for its lack of transparency and organization, what they accused others of they were doing. But actually, she was doing what gamers were accusing the gaming journalism of. You know, she's putting on an event. There's no transparency about, you know, and that's what the gamers are accusing the journalists. So all she did was feed into that lie. So there was a media blackout on this story. The gaming world did not want to touch this story in terms of her cheating, sleeping around. And why would they? Why would they? She is one of theirs, you know. So but in essence, Quinn became a prominent figure in indie game feminism. It's similar to a woman called Anita Sarkeesian. And she's a feminist media critic known for her video series Tropes versus Women in Video Games. And that supposedly analyzed the portrayal of women in video games and popular culture. But she only produced 6 videos after her Kickstarter fund. Or after she got money in her Kickstarter fund. So, I mean, this situation is nothing but a ball of internet hostility, misinformation, personal attacks, and a general breakdown of communication between gamers and journalists that was facilitated by the journalists. The journalists were being attacked for not doing their jobs. They were being called out on the carpet. We all know it's pay to play. We're going to pay you. You're going to play by giving us good reviews. That's just a common tactic. I mean, you just saw it with Dragon Age Veilguard, where this cat gave it a 9 out of 10. Why? Because it had a transgender transgender quest in it. Didn't? What about the actual game? How did it stand up to previous incarnations? How, what did it play? The fighting ability, the storylines, all the quests altogether. He probably rated it a 9 out of 10 based on the fact that it had that one storyline, is my opinion. So they did find journalists that have financial interests in games. Then you also had the small interconnected indie game scene that helped showcase that. They exacerbated the issue with personal and professional relationships. This happens in the sports world too. I come from that sports world. I'm not going to name names, but I was stunned and saddened when I was told about female beat reporters sleeping with players. And I say, well, are they sleeping with them because they like him, or are they sleeping with them for stories? And the guy just gave me a look like, And then I heard that story easily over a dozen times in 10 years with names being named. Not any new names. It's passed by time. I left the industry by the time a lot of these new names. Pretty sure Jemele Hill wasn't one of them. So how come and why does this happen? Easy. Look, in the gaming journalism industry, along with fantasy sports, journalists are often underpaid. They're relying on publishers for both news and advertising. And it's a scenario where integrity is compromised. Here's what I mean by that. Get a part-time gaming journalist writing for IGN. IGN gets a $30,000 1 to 2 month ad buy with a wink, wink. Our games are going to get a good review. You've got to give it a good review because you're a dime a dozen. They'll replace you. It's that simple. And if you're part-time or volunteer, you're not a true journalist in the sense of having the funds to pursue stories that could have been beneficial to the gaming community. They didn't care about that. The full-time people would not do that. Instead, they would focus on maintaining industry relationships or avoiding controversy that might affect their access to previews and events. And I've seen this in the fantasy sports industry as well. This is in every industry. The problem here is that some journalists describe gamers negatively, calling them the worst and a dying identity, misogynist. Despite the fact it's like 48, 46, or like it's literally 50-50 in terms of female gamers and male gamers. It's not all white cis males, as they try to claim. Gaming journalism failed here by not covering the Zoe Quinn controversies. For example, that's what validated it for me. And since you need proof, there's your proof. Instead, they created a media blackout on it, which is contrary to what the media is supposed to do in creating unbiased coverage. They failed when they wouldn't respond, when they wouldn't challenge the accusations. This was industry-wide, why it was called Gamergate, because it wasn't just one or two people. This took over the industry for a while, this topic. That blackout inadvertently supported Gamergate's narrative of corruption, where positive reviews are exchanged for personal or financial gain, as the lack of transparency and coverage seemed to confirm rather than debunk these claims. So when I did not work at Yahoo. When Yahoo was our biggest client, they helped fund my company for 5 years with the ungodly contract they gave us. And I'm not knocking them. It's like nobody saw the numbers coming as they did. And boy, did we live large off that contract in building our company up. And but my point is I got a couple of little simple gifts, baseball. You know, there's a couple of knickknacks. But we didn't – it was two separate divisions, literally. I would negotiate with their business development, then I would talk to their techs. But the business development came second. There was a text who referred us. So we got in that way. But my point is that those two simple gifts are probably less than $20, $30. Could technically have been seen as, hey, they're buying you off. So you got to not allow the perception. It was a baseball. In fact, I'm not sure if you can see it behind me. Maybe you can. Yeah, it's right behind me. You can see it there, that purple one. I've had it. It was my first big sale or I'm sorry, business development deal I did. It's just simple baseball, Yahoo baseball. You know, and at one point, I think they gave them out to everybody at the seminar. This one here, though, hey, I got a gift for you. But technically, that could have been seen. Hey, you know, we did not review software, though. So it didn't really matter. But what I'm trying to sit there and say is anything can be construed negatively. That's why you've got to be extra careful when you're a gaming journalist. You know, so the lack of coverage on Zoe Quinn combined with historical financial dependency in gaming journalism. So that inadvertently is going to support a narrative of corruption. And I say inadvertently because let's say it isn't true, but sure looks true. Positive reviews for advertising dollars. It's pay to play. It's that simple. Outlets are in. It happens today. Even with a new form of gaming journalism, which is YouTube influencers, Twitch gamers. You know, some of these influencers might be given advertising dollars or other incentives to promote games positively or to not highlight issues like bugs, poor gameplay, or ethical concerns. Here's some of the big daddies that have out there 20, 30 million, both men and women, or even a million. They don't necessarily have to give into this. When Kamala Harris was trying to get on some of these gaming podcasts, they blew her off. They didn't need the money. That's the outlier, though. But those are the numbers Kamala was looking for. You know. So what did this do? Well, this created a shift to digital platforms faster than they probably ever saw or thought would happen. If there was no trust in gaming journalists, well, you got all these YouTube influencers who are actually playing the games online, talking about the games, what they like. It's a passion. They just love it. They don't realize at the time, hey, I can make money off this. They eventually would. You know, traditional gaming did move on from print to online in many ways, but not, as I described, one individual with the rise of platforms like YouTube and Twitch, it changed the landscape because these gamers would offer live, interactive, and more engaging content formats simply by playing the game and talking about it. I watch these videos when I game. I was like, oh, man, I'm sick here. I'll go online. Sometimes I just have it on in the background as I'm on the elliptical or something like that. They're really entertaining, especially when you get somebody who's not very good at a game you're pretty good at and you watch them make a fool of themselves. Or you see the so-called expert get taken down. So you have this popularity. It's creating a growing perception in gaming that traditional gaming journalism has completely lost touch with its audience. And there's several reasons why. Obviously, the perceived bias. Many gamers feel that traditional outlets are too influenced by corporate interests. Yes, that is true. Especially because, once again, the advertising revenue and the access to review copies. And that leads to biased reviews, meaning they're all positive. There's a lack of authenticity. Look, independent creators on YouTube, Twitch, and other platforms, they always produce content that feels more genuine and less filtered through corporate lenses. They engage directly with the audience. They provide unscripted and personal insights into the games. I've actually tried streaming a couple of times just for practice. And I can see why people like it, both from that perspective and watching it. Now, there is some value in terms of the gaming world. They have in-depth analysis. They can, if they choose to, still do investigative work. That an influencer doesn't have that capability. Long-form articles, most influencers don't write. You know, it's just about the streaming. So they can, and importantly, they can offer a continuity for gaming history. We need somebody to pen that. Influencers do not do that. But most of them have failed to adapt. Let me talk to you about one of my most famous shows, game shows, and they tried a revival of it, G4 TV. They were once the king of all things gaming. They had their own network on cable. Back in the late 90s into the early 2000s, that was on. My staff and I, we were in our 20s. I mean, I was late 20s, early 30s. They were in their early 20s. We all were gamers. We'd have it on when there wasn't any news happening or something like that. And it was called X-Play. And they eventually went under once the internet took place. They were on once, you know, they were limited in what they could do. They were on a daily show, but you had to sit there and wait for a certain time for them to come on. You could go on the internet, just, hey, I want to check this game out. Somebody up there, not live streaming at the time, but talking about it. So they tried to redo that, but they tried to use, and they used YouTube as a current operating base. But here's the problem. Influencers are a low-cost setup. Webcam, simple streaming, talking in their bedrooms or offices. This is my work office. I have a home office. I have been working from home since the late 90s. So what did G4 TV do? They brought in the studio. Large contracts for the media personalities. Low pay to the production workers. That's the old television formula. And it quickly became unsustainable. And then one of their bigger media personalities named Frost. I think she's a cute little lesbian girl. And I say lesbian girl because she really pushes that. You know, she's proud of that. She's woke. She's this or that. But she went off on a woke rant against, yes, you guessed it, gamers. G4 TV was already struggling. They weren't getting as many viewers as they thought. I mean, they had pretty good, a couple hundred thousand at times, you know, but not for the setup they created. They needed millions and millions, and they weren't getting it. Well, I followed them on other channels just out of nostalgia's sake. When I saw that rant, where she goes, well, if you don't like us, leave. All right. Unsubscribe, 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 unsubscribe. And obviously, I wasn't the only one who did that. Within a few weeks in the month, they'd lost hundreds of thousands. Viewers left in droves. And the collapse was exponentially faster than anyone could have envisioned. Well, I'll say this, though. Some of these gaming magazines, they do have some good reviews and things of that nature. I'm not going to mention which one, probably because I can't remember the name of it. But I will. GameSpot. I still subscribe to their newsletter, one of the few ones. But I don't read the reviews. I don't do any of the reviews. I just use them as markers to what's happening in the news. I pull stories, cool stories. If I see an article, it gives me a reminder. Hey, Amazon Prime is this many, these games they're giving away. You know, Epic is this game they're giving away, et cetera, et cetera. So stuff like that. So traditional journalism can focus on news and in-depth articles because the reviews aren't cutting it. Influencers provide a broader range of content that, like live streaming, gameplay, again, tutorials, speed runs, and community interaction. If there's a bug in the game, you can find out quickly. And that resonates with today's modern culture. You have direct access to these influencers too. Not as much when they get big though. And in defense of these gaming companies, as well as some of the magazines, they develop partnerships with some of these influencers. Now games are being promoted through gameplay streams or product placement within the content of the show or even games itself now. That means that gaming media is really becoming a small-time player. In fact, influencers can build their own communities. So while traditional gaming journalism still holds value, it does, for in-depth analysis, and if they want to investigate a reporting, which they rarely do, they have a place in the community. However, the interactive, immediate, and community-driven nature of content comes from platforms like YouTube and Twitch. And that's shifted where gamers turn to for their information and entertainment. Let's be honest, the ethical issues in both traditional and it will happen in new media will highlight the need or has highlighted the need for transparency and integrity in gaming coverage. And we don't have that, even from the new influencers. We don't. So who are some of these new influencers? Well, let's get to it. And not all these are gamers, but they're in the industry. Here's one called Grungs. Man, I saw this guy go from like 10,000 to 200,000. I've been stuck at 5,000 followers on X for years. But he caught the magic, caught the zeitgeist. And he is Grums, at Grums. He is somebody. He's a former video game executive. He worked on Blizzard Entertainment, World of Warcraft, Diablo II, StarCraft. Now, this is where they catch him. He's been working through something called, he co-founded called Red 5 Studios, where there's a game called Firefall. And I guess people have been saying, where's the game? Where's the game? This has been years. But I don't follow games in that sense when they're in that development type stage. I'm the type of guy as they get closer to coming out. You know, so he's very active. Was active in Gamergate and beyond. He was a vocal figure during the Gamergate controversy, opposing what he saw as unethical practices in gaming journalism. He was on our side. He's now talking about DEI, which there is so much of, the wokeness. He's been at the forefront, and because of his resume, he has a gravitas. And like me, he accuses traditional outlets of gatekeeping, narrative control. In fact, one of the controversies was he had a BioWare scoop with JT Smashmouth. Is that how his name? Yeah. He broke news, and what happened? Mainstream media picked it up. They didn't give him credit. I've seen that in the sports world, too, with the insiders. So what's happened since he's gotten so big? Well, there's Grimm's derangement syndrome. Obviously, a takeoff of TV, yes. And he does call for boycotts against certain AAA games. And I think he has helped push and affected that. Then there's Smash JT. He's emerged as an influencer too, so Smash JT. He rose to prominence as an independent gaming journalist. He has his own YouTube channel and content creator. You know, he criticizes the woke games, and that's been his whole shtick too. He utilizes social media pretty well, and he's growing too. He's got 24,000. He just had a few thousand when I started following him. So he's starting to grow. He's also called for transparency. He was the other half of the Grums half with the BioWare controversy. Now, what makes Smash Mouth JT interesting is he has a conflict with Kotaku and Alyssa Mercante. Mercante filed a lawsuit against him, accusing him of defamation, stochastic terrorism and other charges. It's all untrue. And Smash Mouth has receipts to counter, and she's been made to look the fool right now. And the reason it's important that Alyssa Mercante is a mouthpiece for the woke left in the gaming world at this moment, and especially when she was with Kotaku, who we'll talk about here shortly. JT does engage with the fans. I tried to get him as a guest on this show, and he was too busy, and now he's probably too big. But I'll probably reach out to him in a month or two. But he does deep dives into game mechanics, ethical considerations in game design, and the impact of corporate decisions on gaming culture. And his work has contributed to a growing skepticism amongst us, we gamers, again, towards traditional media sources. For me, it's just validation and seeing the rest of the gaming world finally catch on to what I've known for about a generation now. Then there's this cutie pie. She probably doesn't like me saying that. I've talked about two times. She's a cutie pie, though. Vera Dark. And she's emerged as an influencer. 38,000. She's got tons more on YouTube. I want to say a couple hundred thousand, but I can't remember. But she's emerged as a figure in the gaming community, a woman, young woman. And she's an influencer, reviews games online. And she's been notable in terms about how vocal she's become about the state of modern gaming, too. And obviously, her approach is going to put her at odds with the woke left, including the creator, co-creator, God of War, David Jaffe. And her conflicts with him began when she criticized his comments regarding the failure of Dragon Age: The Veilguard. If I remember correctly, he was blaming the gamers. Typical. He accused Dark of being a grifter, responsible for the game's poor reception. She responded back, but he also resorted to personal attacks on her credibility, her intelligence, and appearance, claiming that her success was largely due to her gender and looks rather than the mirror. I'm going to tell you people a dirty, ugly secret. I have no shame in saying it because it's true. Hot women get more clicks, get more followers. That's just a fact of life. You go on Instagram, look at all those hot women. They do nothing but have these fake little statements like, today is this, or these yoga-ass type statements while they stick their booty out, while they have the deep cleavage. I'm not, Vera Dark does not do that. But when you're... That's just how it works, you know? So, to me, to each their own. God bless you. If I looked like you, I'd be doing the same thing, earning a buck. So what he did, David Jaffe, was become a misogynistic, white, fat, old male. He showed his true colors. He showed what the left really is and how they project who and what they are onto the other side. Like, I'm telling you, that's just the ugly truth. We are going to, at Grunley's Media, have a section on IG one day which features pretty beautiful women in our gear that we sell. That's just how it is. So her response to was swift and sharp. She defended her position. So she's become a player in this too. And she can become a representative of how influencers can challenge traditional narratives in gaming. Now, the allies... For the left, Kotaku. And there's another one. What's the other one? Polygon. So both were established. Kotaku was established in 2004 by Gawker as a gaming blog aimed at younger demographics. But then it was co-opted. Corporate owned now. They were accused and they had moved away from the core focus. They're more into social and political commentary. They are very extremely uber left. They increasingly include topics like DEI, social justice, too many white men, not enough black men, or black women. They don't like black men either. It's all about women and minorities. Controversial reporting. They're also friends of Sweet Baby Inc. I'll tell you about them in a second. There's multiple instances where Kotaku has been accused of unethical behavior. And the site was bleeding money. And what happened? We're going to focus on gaming journals. push towards content, towards how-to guides, whatever they call it, cheat guides, you know? And that includes Alyssa Mercante, who is one of their members. They're struggling. Then there's Polygon, established in 2012. It's literally the same thing. Both outlets share a trend of incorporating social and political commentary. They are biased and woke. Like Kotaku, Polygon has been accused of focusing heavily on social justice issues. You know, they judge games based on how woke those games are. And that's where Sweet Baby Inc. comes in. Before I go into them, both companies, again, to reiterate, criticize games based on their approach to DEI or political themes. Reviews like on games like Stellar Blade. It's Polygon. And just like Kotaku, Polygon has faced significant backlash. So let's get into Sweet Baby Inc. and Kim Belair. Lies and misinformation. That's what they are. There have been accusations that Sweet Baby Inc. under Belair's leadership was more involved in altering game narratives to fit particular ideological viewpoints. We call that the woke agenda. They've lied about their influence or the extent of their involvement in games like Alan Wake 2 and God of War Ragnarok. No, we didn't do anything. My understanding is they tried to get, I can't remember the title of the game, it sold 20 million copies. It was a Chinese company. Tried to get in there for 6 million saying, hey, we want to help you make sure your game is woke enough without saying woke. They told him to go bleep off. And their game went on the sale. Black Myth Wukong sell 20 million copies in a month. Kim Belair has been labeled by some. She has a very anti-white male bias. Oh, this is alleged. I don't know the woman. She's made comments comparing white male gamers to picky babies, and her advocacy for diversity have been the focal points in the controversy with her. And what do? It's misogyny. Misogyny. Everything's misogyny. So let's wrap this up. The landscape of gaming journalism has transformed dramatically, my friends. The rise of influencers, the shift towards platforms like YouTube and Twitch, well, they democratize game critique and news. They've challenged the traditional outlets like Kotaku and Polygon. These changes do reflect a broader cultural shift within gaming, where the community demands more transparency and less political bias. So they're going to where they get that. They want to return to the core elements of what make gaming special. But then you have Liana Hafer, who just keeps ugly going. And I'm not talking about physically, I'm talking about what she does. Engaging in political activism through gaming reviewers. She's not an influencer, but gaming journalism is an influencer of sorts, a dying one, but they are. And her docking point for gamers mentioned the Gulf of America, it highlights political activism and what they prioritize. Activists should exit the gaming industry. Politics do not belong in this space. And look, IGN and PC Gamer, they need to disassociate themselves from her. Him, her. I don't know if it's a him if Hafer has not transitioned. It's a she if he has. I don't think he's transitioned yet. It's clear that the voice of the gamer is louder than ever, my friends. Grums, Smash JT, Vera Dark, William Del Pilar. We push for more inclusive yet critically focused gaming journalism free from the political agenda. All right, let's move on. Let us move on to Captain America, Brave New World, the cinema score and box office. All right, Captain America, Brave New World has defied expectations at the box office. It has secured one of the strongest openings of 2025. That's a cool cover, though, I gotta say. Despite receiving some of the softest reviews and the lowest cinema score in the Marvel Cinematic Universe's history. And that may not bode well. Great cover. That's the Hulk's fingers around it. So they have a 3-day domestic opening weekend of 88.5 million projected 4-day haul of 100 million. It's not a guarantee yet, but that's what it's looking like. The film has captured significant attention, but it does carry some baggage. A B minus Cinema score has mixed critical reception, and it costs, here's a killer, between 350 and 375 million. That's the most expensive number I've ever seen for a movie. And that's because of production challenges, including multiple reshoots and a budget that ballooned, setting the stage for a potentially complex journey at the box office to just break even. So, who is Captain America? Well, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Chris Evans played the character Steve Rogers, who is the Captain America. Why? Because that's who created it, Jim Steranko, and I want to say Jack Kirby, maybe, or maybe it's just Jim Steranko and somebody else. But he does not die in the Marvel timeline, in Avengers Endgame. He's going to return the Infinity Stones to the original timelines, but instead of coming back, he chooses to live out his life in the past with Peggy Carter, the love of his life. So he dies of old age. At the end of Endgame, they show an elderly Steve Rogers. Kind of reminds me of a movie with the Martin Sheen, where he went into the past, stayed in the past. When they showed the movie with the aircraft carrier back in the present, they showed him coming up to the dock, old as dirt. So he then passes shield and mantle of Captain America to Sam Wilson. That was played by Anthony Mackie. That's nothing, nowhere, nothing even close to how the Falcon was done in the magazine or the comic book. So the film has earned $192 million globally, with $92 million coming in from international markets. So it has received the lowest Marvel Comics Universe cinema score, B-, even lower than disappointments like The Marvels and Ant-Man and Wasp Quantumania. Those received a B. And that's important because those movies underperform. And then you have a budget that ballooned to between $350 and $375 million due to reshoots, including a troubled production process. You combine that with the B-, which suggests a lukewarm reception. This could impact its long-term box office performance. So there's a lot of movies that start with a bang and boom. It's 50-60% drop the next week. This score is also in line with Ang Lee's Hulk and Dark Phoenix. And Dark Phoenix was seen as a bomb. Oh, William, B-, ain't all that. You're exaggerating. Well, Captain America, the First Avenger, and Captain America, the Winter Soldier both scored an A. And even the worst one, Captain America, Civil War, earned an A-. So B- is a significant drop. It even had controversy with Captain America, the New World Order. So they changed it to Captain America, Brave New World. Because of political sensitivities. You know, that crap pisses me off. Go with what you want, with what you like. Because it's just a few complaining and whining. And then Harrison Ford's portrayal of Thunderbolt Ross, who is a mainstay character in the whole, and drew comparisons to Donald Trump. So that adds some flavor to it. Oh, man. You know what, though? I had not covered the break-even point. Let me get to that here real quick. All right. It's made $192 million. It is 10% to breaking even. This movie must make anywhere from $1.05 billion to $1.125 billion to break even. That's a lie, William. That's not true. No, they call it the rule of three in Hollywood. And they have to account for marketing, distribution, and other costs that come with it. You've got to understand, in China, for example, they take 25% of ticket sales. China takes the rest. They have to split money, and there are all these costs. And not to mention, you've got the touring payment and AAA or five-star hotels and all this for the stars as they go pump the movie up. They've got a $1.05 billion to $1.1 billion. That's incredible. Incredible. So despite its robust opening, let's be honest, the real test for Captain America Brave New World lies in its ability to maintain momentum. It's also a President's Weekend. So given the mixed reviews and the lowest cinema score in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, sustaining the audience over subsequent weeks is going to be crucial. You can only do that with phenomenal. Man, you got to go see it. It's worth the money. It's worth this. Blah, 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 blah. And that's not happening. Again, the film needs to reach over $1 billion to merely break even. That's a significant challenge. If it can capitalize on the initial draw and overcome the negative word of mouth, there's potential for profitability. But that's a big ask. One thing that has going for it, there's no immediate competition from other blockbusters. So it has a window to prove it has legs at the box office. And whether it can achieve this lofty financial goal, as it's besieged with high production costs, obviously remains to be seen. My prediction, it will be lucky to break even. All right, let's head on to the Rude Rundown, where politics and culture clash. But as I say, politics is always downstream of culture, so politics is always catching up. But they're clashing. They are clashing. Give me one second here. First up is Mr. Ben Stiller. He made some statements on retribution. Ben Stiller expresses fear, stating that there can be retribution from the government if you say something wrong. Where the hell you been at since the Obama administration? I mean, he's concerned over freedom of speech and potential government overreach. Again, where have you been at since 2008? Trump's election has heightened discussions around censorship and political correctness from the left. They're expressing concerns over potential repercussions for their statements. There are going to be no repercussions for their statements. There weren't from 2016 to 2020. This is nothing but public figures spewing showing their hypocrisy. There's a prevalent for fear-mongering from figures like Ben Stiller, who are hypocrites when they comment on issues like free speech, given Hollywood's own history with blacklisting and cancel culture. I mean, do y'all forget in 2021 the DOJ directed the FBI to investigate threats against school board members and claiming parents were domestic terrorists? There were no threats against school board members outside of the wackiness you usually get. But Merrick Garland called parents domestic terrorists. Since Obama's tenure, the FBI has targeted conservatives. Remember the IRS scandal? Remember when they would take years or wouldn't approve nonprofits designation if they were conservative? Then how they handled January 6th, which the truth is coming out. Remember, the January 6th committee destroyed all their notes and evidence. There are people who they said they requested to testify but didn't. These people came back and said, no, they never asked us. We actually went to them saying, we'll testify, but they wouldn't hear us. All kinds of bias. They had over 20 FBI informants of sorts there. Oh, no, we ain't got anybody there. Oh, no, we can't comment on that. Then there's, through since 2008, conservatives being canceled at universities where they're scheduled to speak. Steve Bannon being deplatformed, a judge abusing his power. Ooh, the day he leaves us is the day this planet will be better. He abused his power, threw him in jail, also threw Paul Manafort in jail. And yet all these leftists who have done what these two did are walking free because they were very minor transgressions. Donald Trump was censored and politically persecuted. The government forcing Facebook and persuading Twitter to censor content they disagreed with. I mean, so is Stiller that stupid? Did he miss? Oh, my God. 12, almost 15 years. Where you been the last 15 years? What's sad is he looked honest in that video, but he's an actor. So he's either chosen to remain the fool and not seek out the truth, or he's a liar. It never ceases to amaze me how much of cowards Hollywood has become from the days of understanding and loving this country. When World War II came, professional players and actors, they dropped everything and went to serve. Stiller will only drop his pants looking for his next gig from whoever replaced Weinstein, because when one goes, another fills their place in Hollywood. Stiller is a disgusting joke. Jimmy Kimmel's focus on Trump over ratings. Prioritizing messaging over ratings. Jimmy Kimmel explicitly states that while including Trump supporters might increase his ratings, his primary focus is on repeatedly warning America about the dangers he perceives in Trump. You just heard my last take on Stiller. It's the same thing for him. What is more important to him is, in his mind, lying about Trump, because that's what he does every night, lies about Trump, more than entertaining the people. And the fact that ABC gave him a new contract, well, they were on board. Disney, woke. Disney, who owns ABC, they were trying to indoctrinate your kids. They wanted to teach your kids, hey, tell your parents you're transgender, tell your schoolmate, and they'll tell the school official, and that school official won't tell your parents, and next thing you know, you're going to get castrated. Yeah. I'm being sarcastic with that example, but it's true. That bleep actually has happened. Disney was at the head of it and pushing in that with all its new family programming. So, of course, they gave him a fat contract. He did this on a Malcolm Gladwell podcast. And he asked, hey, is not having a significant portion of the American audience, not that he had anyway, a problem? Kimmel's response was, no, it's a calculated choice. Why? Because he doesn't care that he's screwing his network over. And obviously his network didn't care neither. Kimmel underscores the importance of not normalizing Trump's actions. He wants to demonize Trump. You know, Kimmel, well, I'll give you that in a second. But this is a broader trend in late night TV where political commentary has taken precedence. Their ratings are the lowest they've ever been in the history of late night television. Greg Gutfeld on cable. See, you get free TV with the three networks. You have to pay for Fox Network, Fox News. Greg Gutfeld beats him in the ratings literally every night now. So this approach by Kimmel and Fallon and Colbert highlights a shift in late night television from entertainment focused to politically engaged content that nobody wants. All this shows me is that Kimmel has Trump derangement syndrome and someone completely out of touch. It's also why ratings are dropping and will drop even lower as Trump's successes grow. America loves Doge. This is likely his last year with Kimmel Live. His contract is up in 2025. The winds of change are here, and he hasn't figured that out. And let's not forget, he had derogatory and was a misogynist on The Man Show. He would ask women on the street to guess what was in his pants. With Jimmy, Tootsie Roll. He had inappropriate contact or made inappropriate contact with some of these women, made numerous sexist remarks, mocked women's appearances, their intelligence. And he also did blackface. And again, he was a misogynistic pig. Trump versus the Pulitzer Board. The Pulitzer Board loses. Look, the Pulitzer Board awards journalism's highest honor to what Trump's team called defamatory scam because they gave the Pulitzer Prize to those reporting on the Russia hoax, the Russia collusion narrative. It was a scam. It had claims of Russian collusion to discredit Trump's presidency. And that scam was discredited by various investigations, notably the Mueller report, which did not find evidence of collusion. And they tried to word that so it would still give the appearance, but they couldn't. This narrative was used to undermine his effectiveness in office. And a Florida court rejected the Pulitzer Board's attempts to keep internal discussions about Russiagate. Trump wants it out. How did this come about, this massive lie? So they want to keep the internal discussions about Russiagate prize decisions private, emphasizing a lack of transparency in journalism. Or rather, that's what it's emphasizing. The judge's decision says, no, we need transparency in journalism. Particularly why you came to the decision to give these prizes, knowing how many holes there were in these stories. This ruling comes as Trump's legal battle focuses on bias in journalism. It's been the battle since day one, since yellow journalism with the Hearst newspapers. This is what Trump calls defamatory reporting, and it was. Now, here's a kicker. This lawsuit follows settlements with ABC for $15 million and Meta for $25 million. And he's on the verge of settling with CBS owned by Paramount because they're trying to merge with Skydance. So look for a massive multi-million-dollar settlement there. Look, at the end of the day, the mainstream media is supposed to be our warriors, and they've become nothing but lapdogs for the elites and the Democratic Party. We need Trump to win these cases for anything to bring these institutions to heel so they begin to have unbiased reporting again, if that's even possible. And until that happens, we shouldn't trust one word out of them. In the bigger picture, we should always question them and their sources anyway. CNN correspondent Caitlin Collins deletes a post promoting the Mangione Defense Fund. Let me find that here for you. Caitlin Collins, Luigi Mangione's legal defense team has launched a new website today. So obviously this is a post shared on X. It included information on donating to the legal fund. The post was deleted after massive and significant backlash. Mangione is accused of assassinating UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. Look, we all understand why it happened, but you just can't condone that. Because let me tell you something. Those condoning it, well, your little sister may say the wrong thing to a kid. He blows her head off. Hey, you had it right. She's a bad little girl. Got rid of a bad person. You know? Your grandmother may do something. Don't like her. Boom, blow her head off. Oh, I had a reason. I felt triggered. You know, it gets worse and worse. Be careful what you wish for, because anything can be rationalized. You should be angry at your politicians who are in bed with the healthcare industry. This was a bad dude. The guy who was murdered was a very, very bad dude. But so is Mangione. He's an elitist who was never denied his healthcare. See, every time this is what happens because you deny healthcare. He was never denied healthcare. And here's Caitlin Collins supporting that. Collins responded to the criticism by clarifying she was reporting newsworthy information, not endorsing the fund. That's a crock. She lied as she was busted, showing her true colors. She's okay with murdering, having those she doesn't agree with murdered. That's all that showed. There was nothing newsworthy in that post because she didn't post it as a news post and it wasn't posted via CNN. And there was nothing to show why she posted it. She posted it so people would look at it and go and donate. CNN's Jake Tapper defamation case jury decision. I talked about this a while ago. The defamation lawsuit involving CNN Jake Tapper, the jury awarded $5 million in compensatory damages to Zachary Young, a security contractor for defamation. And this was in relation to a story CNN did about the Afghan refugee evacuation, where they I don't know if it's slander or libel, always get those confused, one of the two. So the case was settled, though, before punitive damages were decided. Here's why I'm reporting this. The jury foreperson indicated that they were looking at awarding him up to $100 million in punitive damages. I speculated on that. The jury foreman confirmed it, or foreperson. They wanted to send a strong message against what they perceived as, quote, fake news and partial truths, unquote. Obviously, the case highlights ongoing concerns about media bias. And again, the legal boundaries of what they can report. They also need to win in order to bring the mainstream media to heel and get them to do what they're supposed to do, not take sides and be unbiased. Moving on. Let's get back to gaming. Adam Sessler's hypocritical attack on Elisa Mercante. I mentioned Elisa Mercante. I mentioned G4 TV, X-Play. And that's where this guy became famous. Well, Sessler is a notorious left-wing hack from G4. He took a hypocritical jab at former Kotaku writer Elisa Mercante. He called her part of the, quote, bullshit factory, unquote, of gaming journalism, which is rich coming from someone who's made a career out of spewing his own brand of nonsense. His critique was a convenient shield for his own biases, targeting Mercante's anti-Semitic allegations and Kotaku drama. He's no better. Yet he ignores his own history of vile, hate-filled rants against conservatives. This is what you call selective outrage. Now, some misguided souls in the gaming community might applaud Sessler's critique. It's clear they're just as blind to his own contributions to the sensationalist bias cesspool he's now criticizing. Think about that. His words actually ring hollow. His criticisms of others like Mercante reek of projection, especially when he's no stranger to the controversy and has no moral high ground to stand on. Sessler has shown his own significant disdain to gamers, calling them, quote, fucking children, unquote, and criticizing the gamer identity as immature. He suggests gamers contribute to the toxicity and are part of the problem in the gaming industry. I mean, you just heard some of the quotes I said. I mean, it's like the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, he's been harsh, not only to Republicans, but he had a controversial tweet that he wished death upon his own Republican family members, calling them, quote, stupid, racist, and drink piss, unquote. He's a nut job. He's something sick in his head. So his criticisms of Mercante, as deserved as they are a bit hypocritical, given his own extreme and offensive political commentary. Again, the pot calling the kettle black. And I'm not a supporter of Mercante at all either. The 50th SNL anniversary. Al Franken admits SNL liberal bias in a recent essay. Look, in a New Times essay, do I got a picture of Al? Yes, I do. This was Al on SNL. So he did an essay on Time, in a New Time essay, I guess Time magazine. Al Franken, he's a former writer and performer on SNL. He acknowledged the show's current liberal bias, contrasting it with the nonpartisan approach during his tenure. He states, quote, our goal was to get laughs from everyone, emphasizing the show's original intent to, or unquote, emphasizing the show's original intent to avoid taking sides. Well, I don't know. I mean, they did have dual. It was a little bit less woke, but it was still woke. But he talks about how the show shifts towards advocacy with the left began during Trump's presidency. No, it began before then. My take is simple. Despite Lorne Michaels and other SNL figures who deny the show's liberal bias, look, Franken's comments validate criticism from conservatives who argue that SNL has become a mouthpiece for Democrat narratives. Let me shorten that up. We've always known that SNL has been a leftist voice, and Franken validates it. I mean, look at Trump versus any Democrat since the turn of the century. They don't criticize Democrats since the turn of the century. That's why I don't believe Al Franken. Obama went 1,000 for 1,000 at-bats and positive pieces with nothing negative ever done. Look, Franken's a liberal senator from Minnesota. He may still be bitter at the fact that he did that in a picture in front of a woman's breast. Wasn't touching her. Wasn't nothing. It was just a little joke. And they forced him to resign because conservatives used liberals' tactics against him, and the left felt we gotta live up to what we state we are. So he became the sacrificial lamb. Nobody else did. It was just the old white guy. Think about that. Sheryl Crow sells Tesla, donates to NPR in protest of Elon Musk. What an idiot. Here's a picture of her waving goodbye to her Tesla. Sheryl Crow has sold her Tesla vehicle and donated the money to NPR. She cites Elon Musk's influence and his role in Trump admin, specifically Doge. She refers to NPR as under threat by President Musk. Obviously, there's been a lot of pushback, backlash, you idiot, you this, you that. There's been support of her. But I got to be honest. NPR should not rely on federal funding. If you want to exist, NPR, exist on your own, because I don't need you to use my money to talk bad about me. Anything government funded should be neutral in this sense, and it's not. It's full-blown leftist, NPR/PBS. This is more about Sheryl Crow and her celebrity activism. Musk has previously advocated for NPR to lose federal funding as well. Look, all this is Sheryl Crow virtue signaling for popularity to go, I'm with you. I feel your pain. What's that? I got my spa treatment in an hour? All right. That's a long walk to my spa wing of my house. Look, Crow only hurts herself because she loses fans. But at the end, she doesn't care because she's so rich, she can weather any policy her ideology enacts that hurts the working class and the poor. It's that simple. She's okay with Americans being hurt because she can survive it. She shows she's out of touch. And she really wants NPR to stick around because they're as leftist as she is. And the truth is, it's no longer needed. PBS and NPR were there because we needed more options outside of the handful that were around. But now with streaming, podcasting, we don't need NPR. Disney's DEI discourse. Staffers feel abandoned, by Bob Iger. Look, Disney employees are expressing disappointment with Bob Iger, the CEO, accusing him of, quote, pandering to MAGA, unquote, because he's scaling back diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI. They see this as capitulation to political pressures from the Trump admin. Look, Disney faces challenges with declining box office performances and a brand perceived to be in free fall. They're losing subscribers. They're facing investor backlash, all because of their DEI policies. Look, Iger has made a decision to remove transgender storylines and canceling certain DEI programs. He needs to repair its brand. This aligns more closely with conservative values. And let's be honest, that's always been their bread and butter. But it's caused a rift within leftists in the company. And they'll be gone. Just fire them all, let them walk, etc., etc. However, Iger's contract does end in 2026, and there's speculation which direction will Disney go. I hope it continues to shift from DEI to brand rehabilitation. The U.S. court upholds R. Kelly's 30-year sentence for racketeering and sex trafficking. There's a picture of Mr. Kelly. Robert Sylvester Kelly, known publicly as R. Kelly, is an American singer, songwriter. He's a record producer who rose to fame in the R&B genre with hits I Believe I Can Fly. He earned multiple Grammy Awards and was a significant influence in the music industry during the 90s and early 2000s. The Second U.S. Circuit of Appeals affirmed the use of RICO against Kelly. He rejected the claim that his employees lacked criminal intent and confirmed his leadership in a criminal enterprise. They recognized the substantial evidence showing Kelly's systematic manipulation and abuse of young girls. That's what he went in for, abusing young girls. And that came about his 2021 trial. So Kelly's legal team does plan to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's a long shot, to be honest, but never say never. And he's appealing the use of the RICO statute. The court dismissed Kelly's argument about biased jurors and the admissibility of evidence, solidifying the legal basis for his 30-year sentence. Man, this just seems prevalent. Child abuse in a lot of the elites in various industries. The lust for young flesh. But what scares me is a continual mantra from the left in grooming children. Is their goal to eventually have American society accept this? One would think so based on the accepting of transgenders, the mutilation of children by stating they're able to make adult decisions. So it's okay to cut the breasts off, to castrate them. They know what they want. These are children with underdeveloped brains. Your brain does not stop forming until your late 20s. Is this a precursor towards kids saying they want a relationship with an older person and a court accepting it? It would seem so in the long run. As crazy as that sounds, we have never been more accepting of this grossness, travesty of pedophilia than what the Democrats are doing with keeping secrets from parents, with kids being confused, and they're not confused, they're just being told what they are by teachers at schools. The indoctrination is all vile, it's all evil. So I'm glad to see R. Kelly not win his appeal. A court found him guilty. Bonus question. DCU omits Dean Cain from Superman pick. At DCU World on X posted an image of multiple Superman actors, but more than likely, they purposely omitted Dean Cain, who plays Superman in Lois and Clark, by cropping him out from the original photo shared by Screen Rant. Here's the photo. You see him, see the top part is a cropped out, Dean Cain cropped out. And they did that. There's no denying it. I mean, at least that's what I believe. Fans obviously quickly noticed an omission, leading to widespread criticism of DCU updates for their deceptive editing, which I agree. Dean Cain himself responded humorously to the exclusion, tweeting, "Did cut me out," with a smiley, highlighting the absurdity of the situation. Yeah, I got to be honest. You know, these guys, I think one of these two, there's two or three of them. There's three of these two. The one with the glass, the two with the glasses never played Superman. They voiced him. Obviously, that's Brandon Routh, who played Superman in one film. That's a new Superman for the last couple of years on CW. I don't know his name. And there's Tom something, who played Smallville. Tom Welt played Smallville. He looks so different now. Obviously, you look below, there's the most famous one of them all. Tom Welling, that's his name, Tom Welling. But the most famous one of them all out of that list is Dean Cain there on the right. There was just magic about his show that people love. You know? So obviously this has raised questions about the reliability of DCU as a source of information. This much bias undermines your credibility. It does more than that. It shows that they've embraced woke narratives, evident in the casting choices they've also made, like a non-binary Robin, focusing on social justice themes in some of their recent projects. So now they're full-blown woke. That's why this happened. And that contrasts with Dean Cain's staunch conservative views, making him a notable figure of traditional values in contrast to the current direction of DCU storytelling. And there you have it, my friends. This week's Red, White, and Rude. Do not forget to like and share this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did researching it and bringing you the information. Do not forget you can find this podcast, the Red, White, and Rude, as well as my conservative political talk, Fired Up, as well as my new podcast, Fired Up California. And I do have a political sports show called Points on the Board. You can find all of those at grumblingsmedia.com, as well as YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, and Pandora under the profile handle Grumblings Media. It has been a pleasure, my friends. I am William Del Pilar. This is the Red, White, and Rude. And until next week, I bid you adieu.